Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present John J. Mersheimer, University of Chicago political science professor and author, who discusses the danger posed by the ongoing conflict in Ukraine and the escalation of tensions between the U.S., NATO, and Russia. Rabbi Mordecai Liebling of the Reconstructionist Rabbinical College in Philadelphia, who talks about how interfaith groups around the U.S. are responding to the Pope's climate change encyclicals call for action. And Nick Neihardt of the group Every Voice Center, who assesses the current campaign to pressure Congress to restore the Voting Rights Act of 1965 that was gutted in a 2013 Supreme Court decision. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In the face of a new wave of immigrants, leaders of the European Union have agreed to take in 40,000 refugees who have landed in Italy and Greece in recent months. But heated disagreements among European leaders forced the EU to reject any formula or quota to process the refugees among EU nations. Thus far in 2015, nearly 185,000 asylum seekers have landed in EU nations, a spike of 86% over a year earlier. Inside Europe, there are signs of growing resistance to increased immigration from Middle East war zones and impoverished nations. Anti-immigration political parties have won recent elections in Denmark and Austria. The draft European Union migration plan, obtained by the Guardian newspaper, gives the EU border agency Frontex broad new powers to identify, register, and deport migrants, but rejects establishing any formal national quota for accepting new refugees. On the eve of the EU summit, Doctors Without Borders issued a statement that charged that the current emergency is an orchestrated humanitarian crisis created by the failure of the EU to put in place adequate and humane policies. Member states spend their time talking about closing borders, building fences, and issuing threatening ultimatums. More than 20 years after Rwanda's genocide, which killed over 800,000 people in a matter of weeks, the East African nation is experiencing increasing growth and development, even as it continues efforts to end ethnic conflict. Yet tension between ethnic groups remains, especially for the native indigenous Twa people, who have been displaced from traditional hunting grounds and struggle to hold on to their culture. Unlike the Hutus and Tutsi people, the Twa are neither victims nor perpetrators of the 1994 genocide, but remain a distinct ethnic group. Many Twa who have been expelled from their native forests now must work as day laborers to survive. After the genocide, the Rwandan government passed laws against ethnic divisionism and genocide ideology and banned the ethnic labels Hutu and Tutsi. Many of the nation's citizens were sent to re-education camps to unlearn tribal prejudice and help build a new Rwanda. But despite 20 years of economic progress, the Twa people remain desperately poor and live at the margins of Rwandan society. California's historic 1975 Agricultural Labor Relations Act, known as the Farm Workers Law, is under threat after a state appeals court in Fresno overturned the law's mandatory mediation powers. Under the law's mandatory mediation provision, a negotiator can be called in to settle a union grower contract dispute if the employer refuses to negotiate for a first-time contract. After talking with both sides, the mediator can recommend a settlement. An appeal is expected before the California Supreme Court. The current court case involves Growen Farms, which harvests peaches and grapes in Fresno. Growen has challenged the farm workers' law with the support of national right-wing and anti-union groups. A state mediator called for a union contract at the farm that employs 5,000 farm workers, requiring equal wages for similar jobs, and a prohibition on discrimination. The 1975 Agricultural Labor Practices Act created a legal process for farm workers to unionize, making it illegal for employers to retaliate against workers seeking to organize. According to the news magazine In These Times, after more than a decade of negotiations failed to produce a contract with Growen Farms, the United Farm Workers renewed its drive for a contract and called in a state mediator. The grower replied by launching a drive to decertify the farm workers' union. If the mandatory mediation powers are rejected by the California Supreme Court, it would be a dramatic blow to farm workers organizing in many states in the U.S. and the campaigns they wage to enforce meaningful labor contracts. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
Growing tensions between the U.S. and Russia went into high gear after Ukraine's elected president, Viktor Yanukovych, was ousted from power in February 2014, triggering Russia's decision to annex Crimea and provoking the ongoing conflict in eastern Ukraine between pro-Moscow separatists and the Kiev government's army and militia groups. Now, after the imposition of months of U.S. and European economic sanctions against Vladimir Putin's government, a new, more dangerous escalation is underway. U.S. Defense Secretary Ash Carter announced on June 23rd that the Pentagon will pre-position tanks, artillery, and other military equipment in Eastern and Central Europe in a move, he said, was designed to reassure NATO allies alarmed by Russia's actions in Ukraine. Moscow condemned the move, maintaining that this was the most aggressive U.S. act since the end of the Cold War. President Putin stating that Russia was concerned about a U.S.-NATO anti-missile defense system near its borders had decided to deploy more than 40 intercontinental ballistic missiles, or ICBMs, to its nuclear arsenal this year. This most recent war of words followed the April launch of 6 months of military exercises, dubbed Operation Fearless Guardian, that involves 290 American paratroopers and 900 Ukrainian soldiers near the Ukraine-Polish border. Your reporter spoke with John J. Mearsheimer, University of Chicago professor of political science and author, who discusses the danger posed by the ongoing conflict in Ukraine and the escalation of tensions between the U.S., NATO, and Russia.
First of all, it was not Russian aggression that caused this crisis. It was the West's attempt to take Ukraine and peel it away from Russia's orbit and make it part of the West. NATO expansion, EU expansion, and democracy promotion were all part of that strategy. That's what caused the crisis. The Russians didn't cause the crisis. Putin didn't cause the crisis. Second point is, what we're now doing is, in effect, doubling down. And what we're talking about doing is moving equipment into Eastern Europe, training the Ukrainian army, maybe even arming the Ukrainian army. All of these things are going to make a bad situation worse. And in fact, what we're doing here is pursuing a policy that's guaranteed to make sure that the Russians never cut a deal with us over Ukraine. And in fact, the Russians go to great lengths to wreck Ukraine, which is what they're in the process of doing.
Professor Mearsheimer, as you've written, what's going on now in Ukraine is comparable for what maybe U.S. policymakers were concerned about during the Cuban Missile Crisis, where Russia was placing armaments and nuclear missiles on the island nation of Cuba, just 90 miles from the Florida shore. And you posit the fact that if Russia or China or any world power were to make a military alliance with Canada or Mexico, that the United States would similarly have a real problem with that and would use the military to confront that perceived threat. You want to expand on that?
Sure. The United States has the Monroe Doctrine. And the Monroe Doctrine says that no distant great power, in other words, no European or Asian great power, can form a military alliance with a country in the Western Hemisphere or station military forces in the Western Hemisphere. We consider that to be unacceptable. And of course, during the Cold War and during the Cuban Missile Crisis, when the Soviets were attempting to station nuclear-armed missiles in Cuba, the United States went ballistic. And as you said, and I said in the piece, if Canada or Mexico in the future were to form a military alliance with China and invite China to station military forces in either Canada or Mexico, the United States would go absolutely ballistic. We just would not tolerate that. We'd go to great lengths to prevent it. Now, why shouldn't the same logic apply to the Russians with regard to Ukraine? Ukraine is right on Russia's doorstep. They share a huge border. from Russia's point of view, moving a military alliance like NATO, which is a former enemy, onto their doorstep is just unacceptable to Putin and his lieutenants. Monroe Doctrine logic should have applied in the Russian case just as it applies in the American case.
Thank you for that, Professor Mearsheimer. You have suggested that the conflict, the ongoing conflict in Ukraine, could be tamped down by an agreement on all sides that Ukraine should remain a neutral state with good relations with both the West and Moscow, ending the deadly conflict that's going on now in eastern Ukraine between pro-Russian separatists and the government in Kiev.
My view on the future of Ukraine is that there are two broad choices. One is that if we in the West continue to fuel the crisis by supporting the Ukrainians and poking the Russians in the eye with a stick, that what's going to happen is Ukraine is going to be wrecked as a functioning society. What's going on now is a disaster for Ukraine. So that's one alternative. The second alternative is if we back off, we meaning the West, and we create, working with the Russians, a neutral Ukraine, their future will be much brighter. I think what has to be done here, and this gets to the solution, is that we have to go back to the status quo that existed in the 1990s and throughout most of the early 2000s. NATO expansion has to be taken off the table. NATO has to say explicitly, Ukraine is not going to become part of NATO. And instead, what has to happen is that the Russians, the European Union, the International Monetary Fund, the Americans have to work together to create an economic package to bring Ukraine back from the dead. And then we have to go to great lengths to try and help the Ukrainians create some sort of federal political system that allows them to repair the relations between the Russian speakers in the East and the Ukrainian speakers in the West. I mean, you have something of a civil war taking place inside of Ukraine at the moment, and that has to be shut down. And we have to help the Ukrainians figure out clever strategies to bring that conflict to an end.
That was John J. Mearsheimer, the R. Wendell Harrison Distinguished Service Professor and co-director of the Program on International Security Policy at the University of Chicago. Professor Mearsheimer is author of The Tragedy of Great Power Politics and co-author with Stephen M. Walt of The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy. Find more analysis and commentary on the rising tensions between the West and Russia by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The Vatican's encyclical, Praise Be, or Laudato Si in Latin, was released on June 18th and focuses on the need for people across the world to take action to reverse global warming caused by human activity. In this long-awaited document, Pope Francis makes an impassioned plea for humans to recognize the interconnectedness of all life on Earth, to recognize that the poor of the Earth are suffering the most from climate change, and that it's humanity's responsibility to address the crisis. The scientific consensus is that Pope Francis correctly relates the science research on climate change, but his encyclical has been criticized by some for its rejection of market-based solutions to reduce climate change through mechanisms such as carbon trading. Pope Francis addressed his encyclical to all people of the earth, not just Catholics, and members of many religions are heeding his call. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Rabbi Mordecai Liebling, director of the Social Justice Organizing Program at the Reconstructionist Rabbinical College in Philadelphia, where he trains rabbis in social justice organizing and related topics. He recently taught a course called Rabbi as Environmental Activist. Here he explains why he's inspired by the Pope's encyclical and how interfaith groups are responding to the Pope's coming visit to the U.S. this September.
Knowing that the encyclical was going to be released, several of us initiated a rabbinic letter on the environment called Bringing in Jewish Values to Address Climate Change. And we raised, you know, in much shorter form, many of the issues that the Pope raised. Climate change is the predominant moral issue of our time. Every religious person, regardless of your faith tradition, needs to understand that climate change or the desecration of the earth is the moral issue of our lifetime. And as the moral issue, each of us has wisdom in our faith traditions to bring to bear on it. And a piece of the wisdom has to do with how we treat the earth. All of our religions honor creation and have many teachings about the importance of the sanctity and the holiness of the earth. And what we see now is the desecration of the earth.
In the civil rights movement, there was a lot of interconnections among people of faith, various different faiths. People risked their lives and some people lost their lives. Do you see this as, and the letter that you just mentioned, do you see this as sort of contributing to, you know, really stepping up the work of trying to make more people aware of the issue and really maybe getting politicians to take action?
Yes. Right now in 30 or more states, there's an organization called Interfaith Power and Light, which is an interfaith group that's concerned about climate change. And I think the Pope's encyclical is going to inspire many more people of faith to get involved in organizations like Interfaith Power and Light. There's another group called Interfaith Moral Action on Climate Change that is mostly headquartered in Washington, D.C., and trying to pressure Congress to make change on these issues. It's interesting that a number of Catholic legislators have already responded to the Pope in some way and saying we have to take this seriously. So the Pope's doing this is going to have a large impact on politicians as well as other folks. Remember, Catholicism still is the largest single religion in the United States, and it is going to influence tens of thousands, if not millions, of Catholics in the United States to be involved in this issue. And that kind of mass movement will translate into pressure on politicians to begin to act more resolutely on this issue.
It's interesting, though, that some of the politicians, the Catholic politicians and some of the presidential candidates, basically some of them are saying, well, the Pope should really stick to what they're calling, stick to religion and not meddle in politics. So it's going to be interesting when he speaks to Congress, since he's been invited by the Catholic Speaker of the House to address the body. But do you have any thoughts about those recalcitrant Catholics who really, this is probably the last thing they want to hear?
Well, I think, you know, it's very interesting. You know, when the issue was abortion, they were very happy to be good Catholics and follow the teachings of the church. So it was convenient for them. But now when the church's teachings are challenging them, they are taking a giant step away from the church's teaching. So that is indicative of how much we can trust those folks. The Pope will be addressing Congress, coincidentally, the day after Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, the sort of holiest day on the Jewish calendar. And some of us are going to hold a Yom Kippur service in Washington, D.C. at the Lincoln Memorial the day before the Pope speaks to Congress. The night that Yom Kippur ends, we're going to be joining with an interfaith service with some Franciscans to begin a vigil before the Pope speaks to Congress. I think that the Pope's doing this is a courageous act and is hopefully a game changer. His rooting all of this teaching in the truth of the interconnectedness of all life is something that will be an inspiration for tens of millions of people.
That was Rabbi Mordechai Liebling, director of the Social Justice Organizing Program at the Reconstructionist Rabbinical College in Philadelphia. Learn more about Faith Community's response to the Pope's climate change encyclical by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. June 25, 2015, marked the second anniversary of the U.S. Supreme Court ruling in the Shelby County v. Holder case that effectively dismantled the 1965 Voting Rights Act. Since then, 21 states across the nation have imposed new obstacles to voting. These include the establishment of new restrictive voter ID laws, limiting the days and hours for early voting, and regulations making registering new voters more difficult. These new electoral regulations, ushered in by mostly Republican governors and legislatures, disproportionately erode the voting rights of African Americans, Latinos, students, senior citizens, and other voters viewed as likely to cast ballots for Democratic Party candidates. Civil rights movement veteran and Congressman John Lewis is a co-sponsor of the Voting Rights Advancement Act that was introduced on June 24th, legislation that seeks to restore key sections of the 1965 Voting Rights Act removed by the Supreme Court in 2013. 70 pastors, members of the Progressive National Baptist Convention, gathered in Washington on the anniversary of the High Court ruling to pressure lawmakers to support the bill that would restore the Voting Rights Act. But Congressman Bob Goodlatte, a Republican who represents part of Roanoke, Virginia, and chairs the House Judiciary Committee, has blocked action on the proposed voting rights restoration bill. On June 25th, a coalition of labor, civil rights, voting rights, environmental, and good government groups held a rally in Roanoke calling on Representative Goodlatte to allow debate on the Voting Rights Advancement Act. Your reporter spoke with Nick Neihardt, president and CEO of the group Every Voice Center, who participated in the Roanoke rally. Here he assesses the current campaign to pressure Congress to restore the 1965 Voting Rights Act.
One of the most important parts of the Voting Rights Act that was passed in 1965 was its Section 5. And that basically said, if any state that has had a history of discrimination in establishing or implementing voting laws wants to change their laws, they have to be pre-cleared in advance. In other words, before these laws can be put into effect, the United States government, through the Justice Department, has to vet them for any discriminatory aspects. And so that was a very powerful weapon, and there were over 200 laws or proposals that were invalidated. The Justice Department said, you can't do this. But what's even more important, perhaps, is that people wouldn't even try. If there was something that would be discriminatory on its face, it wouldn't be introduced because it was clear that the Justice Department would say, no way, you can't do that. And then the Supreme Court, the Roberts Court, which has done so much damage on money in politics, 2 years ago in June 2013, said, you know what, these laws were written up and these standards were established in 1965, and surely we've made huge progress on discrimination. And the conditions that existed then that required us to take these extraordinary measures don't really necessarily exist today. And so we're going to scrap that. And Congress, if you determine that there's still discrimination, you're free to pass another updated law 50 years later that's attuned to these modern times. Now, in some ways on the surface, that may make some sense. But when you look at the electoral map and look at the situation in many of the same southern states and other states that were had to go through this pre-clearance, the conditions are really pretty tough, and there had been repeated attempts, stopped only by Section 5, to change the law. So as soon as you removed the pre-clearance, as soon as the Supreme Court invalidated this very powerful tool that the Justice Department had, states went back and started implementing restrictions on voting rights right and left all over the place.
What's the status of the effort to restore the voting rights in Congress right now, given that there's certainly a revival of the civil rights movement we've seen in the Black Lives Matter movement, a lot of reaction, of course, after the massacre of those 9 African-American church parishioners in Charleston, South Carolina? It seems like there's every reason in the world why Congress should act here, but, of course, the political interests conflict with that.
Right. I mean, there is a problem in that there's a majority in Congress that probably doesn't want to see these laws enacted right now, and it'll take citizen pressure and I think moral pressure as well to change that. There is a new Voting Rights Advancement Act, which basically takes the Supreme Court at its word and says, okay, let's establish new standards going forward and reestablish preclearance, but we'll look at current standards. And so there's a guideline that they have as part of this new act, the Voting Rights Advancement Act, that says any state that has 15 or more voting rights violations in the last 25 years would be subject again to preclearance. And if you use that standard, there are 13 states that would be subject to preclearance. And some of them are southern states, like Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, South Carolina, North Carolina, and Florida, Louisiana. But some are elsewhere. So California and New York are also in there, where there have been examples of bias and violations found in the voting laws. So this would count a lot of different states in this net in a modernized preclearance regime. So there it is. But the chair of the Judiciary Committee, Representative Bob Goodlatte from Roanoke, Virginia, serving in the district that serves the Roanoke area, said, we're not going to even have a hearing on this. And the rationale is that, well, things have changed. There really isn't a problem anymore. And I think the voting rights activists have said, well, there is a problem. If you have a hearing, we can demonstrate that there's a problem. And yet he said, has espoused no interest in having a hearing. And I was part of a group of campaign finance reform advocates among us, but also environmentalists and civil rights activists who traveled to Roanoke, Virginia last week to protest in his district the fact that he won't even consider a hearing. He won't even let the facts come to light on voting rights and what should be done about to protect them now. So there are about 500 people gathered for a rally in his district, just a block away from his office. And I think the important thing, and you've mentioned this, Scott, about sort of people standing up to racial discrimination, the important thing was the whole swath of groups assembled for this. There were organizations representing young people and older people. There were union officials there. There were gay rights activists there. There were African-American groups, certainly, but there were also Latino organizations, Asian-American organizations who spoke up against discrimination and against Bob Goodlatte's decision not to even have a hearing. And our hope is that we can change this, but what it will take is casting a broader light on his refusal to let this even have the light of day inside the halls of Congress. But again, I think seeing a much broader community take up the issue of voting rights and having hundreds and hundreds of people turn out, including a couple hundred who were on a 3.5-hour bus ride just to get there, is very exciting and certainly bodes well for people standing up for democracy and making change.
That was Nick Neihardt, President and CEO of Every Voice Center. Learn more about the campaign to restore the 1965 Voting Rights Act by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.